I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Nancy Lechuga.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, our guest is the poet Shin Yi Pai, whose new book, Ozark, just came out. And she's going to talk a little bit about this book. She's a fantastic writer and she's a photographer like me. I'm kind of an amateur photographer. She's actually going to read the poem of the week today, and it should be a great show. Nancy, thanks for being in the studio with me again.
I'm glad to be here again.
The funny thing is, we had scheduled Shin Yi Pai to be on the show about 3-4 weeks ago. And the day she was supposed to be on the show, I showed up. I had my headphones on, but she had delivered her baby that morning.
Oh.
Can you believe that? How irresponsible that was to miss a show just for a baby?
Oh, that's very relatable. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I know having a kid is a game changer, but parents hate what I'm about to say. I have a dog. And it's almost the same.
No, yes, dogs are definitely family members. I totally understand.
Yeah, no, it isn't quite the same. But you know what the weird thing is that when you have a dog, I had my dog before Kafka. Right now my dog is Kafka. And I'm doing a book tour this year. So my dog is staying with a friend, a really good friend of mine in Fresno. But before Kafka, I had a dog named Felix. And Felix was with me, you know, from the time he was a little puppy all the way until at 11 years old, he died. And his death, and this is going to sound really weird and insensitive, but I find this is true with a lot of people and dogs that have been with them for all their lives. His death was more devastating to me than when my father died.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's strange. I love my father, you know, and I miss him deeply. But when Felix died, it was like, I remember I was driving and I hadn't told anybody yet because I knew if I told them, I would just break down and cry. And this was 2 weeks after he died. And a friend of mine called and I, you know, illegally picked up my cell phone and says, "Hey, what you doing?" And I told him about Felix and I had to pull over the car because I just couldn't handle it. I find people who lose dogs that have been with them for that long have this same experience. And even years later, you can have a dream about the dog and wake up crying.
Well, it's because dogs are such sensitive creatures and people just make such personal connections with them. So I don't think it's shocking per se.
No.
I think it's you feel sometimes more comfortable opening up or kind of expressing your feelings towards an animal.
Yeah, dogs are always there with you. And you know what? You could never do wrong with a dog. You know, a dog, you can be the biggest jerk in the world. The dog's still going to love you and want to cuddle up next to you. And you know what dogs want? And this is why any dog is trainable. This is just a fact. Any dog is trainable. A lot of times people think, oh, my dog can't be trained. He's got a personality of his own. But the fact is any dog is trainable because you know what they want? They want to be part of the pack. They're pack animals. And, of course, they want meat as well. And so it's easy to train a dog with meat and that desire to be part of the pack. But they're always there.
They give you unconditional love, like the real, real unconditional
Absolutely.
Love.
Absolutely. And so. They like meat. I'm Daniel Chacon. Stick around with me and Nancy Lechuga, and we're going to talk to the wonderful, talented, beautiful poet Shin Yi Pai on Words on a Wire.
Shin Yi Pai is the author of several poetry books, including most recently Adamantine. Her work has been commissioned twice by the Dallas Museum of Art, and she is a former writer-in-residence for the Seattle Art Museum. A visual artist, she has exhibited her work at the Patterson Museum, the McKinney Avenue Contemporary, and the Three Arts Club of Chicago. She is a former curator for the Whitliff Collections and has taught creative writing at the Southern Methodist University and the University of Texas at Dallas. Shin Yi received her MFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and studied at Naropa University. Welcome, Shin Yi, to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
We're talking about your new book, Ozark, but I want to clarify something so the listeners who don't have the book in front of them don't think I'm saying the Ozarks. It's Ozark, which is French for of the Ark, but it's pronounced Ozark. So I just discovered this like 2 minutes ago, and it didn't occur to me. But once it occurred to me, it's a brilliant title. Congratulations also on a beautiful book.
Thank you. Thank you. So the title, when I was doing some research about the region from which I was sort of writing these poems and focusing the work, I found that this old spelling or sort of French way of saying Ozarks, which means of or from Arkansas. And so I wanted to kind of ground the book very specifically in geography, but wanted to also arc out or expand beyond it just being a book that would be about place, because it's a book that sort of travels to many different places.
Right. You're a visual artist, too. You're a photographer, and people can go to your webpage and look at some of your photographs. Your photographs are wonderful. I love the way you play with black and white and the way you play with light and texture. What is the relationship between your photos and your poems, if any?
I guess I should say that in my creative practice, my photographic practice and my writing practice have been very separate, probably up until I feel like this book, Ozarks, in which I thought very deliberately about how I might curate images that sort of explored different themes into a collection that could also talk to texts or poems that wanted to have a conversation about these sort of topics, I guess. And mm-hmm. So the relationship in the past has not been necessarily very explicit, but I do feel like I guess these two separate practices for me are ways to explore themes that I'm working with that, you know, sometimes it takes a different form, whether a prose poem or, you know, an image that can kind of help unpack for me an idea that I want to work through. And so I see them as different kinds of tools, I guess. And I hope to work towards a point where they are more integrated in a way and, you know, more sort of hybrid in a way. But I guess that's the best way to sort of talk about how these practices currently operate for me.
That makes complete sense. And is this the first book that you've written? I know you have many other books, but is this the first book you've written where you've actually included some of your photographs?
My first collection was La Alameda Press, called Equivalence. It came out in 2003. That also incorporates two black and white images of my photographic work, actually, as a sort of frontispiece and an end piece, sort of bracketing the text.
And it's interesting because some of your photographs on your webpage, there's not a lot of people in them, right? There's a lot of shapes and there's color. You know what it is that you're looking at, but there's really just shape and light. And they're not necessarily abstract, although some of them, you know, could be. And your poems, of course, are really much more visual, and there's a lot of people that populate your poems.
Yeah, that's a really good observation, actually. So in my photographs, like, I often think of myself as focusing more on landscape or still life, even when these sorts of things are abstracted. And you're completely right. They're notably absent of people, which is a subject that I have a little bit more, I think, difficulty with photographing. I think that it takes a certain kind of photographer to sort of capture human expression and faces. Mm-hmm. But it definitely manifests very much in the written work in terms of being very attentive to voices and how individuals are represented. So I do think that that's a very sharp observation about how these two sort of practices do contrast. Yeah.
Our producer was telling me that you just had a baby recently.
Yes.
I was actually reading one of the poems, and I write poetry myself, and I don't know if you've already gotten around to writing since you have a little one, and I know how tough that could be. If you have started writing, how has motherhood shaped your poetry? Have you experienced that yet?
I think I'm going through the shift now, to be honest. So I got up really early, you know, so that I could, you know, have a clear head for this interview, and found myself with an extra hour of time, which is rare and precious at this time.
Yes.
My son is 1 month, he's 6 weeks old, actually, so still needing a lot of attention and time. And so I had this extra hour of time, and I've been sketching down ideas and sort of phrases for poems I've been thinking about writing, and sort of worked on two pieces before getting on the phone with you guys, actually.
Yeah.
And
had,
Yeah, and I've been kind of thinking about, well, how do you carve out time as a new mother to, to, you know, continue in this discipline? And I was actually thinking, well, you know, it might work for me to get up early every morning before the day starts while I'm on maternity leave and just kind of, you know, write through a couple of the ideas that I've been thinking about for the last month and a half. And, you know, the perfect place is my kitchen table. It's, like, quiet. There's lots of surface space. I'm overlooking my neighborhood and kind of just figuring out what the new writing routine or discipline is going to look like, because it's completely shifting.
Yes.
And I feel like in terms of, like, the subject matter that's shifting, you know, right now I'm thinking a lot about, I guess, how my identity is changing and how I'm thinking about motherhood and my relationship to this very, you know, new person in the world. And simultaneously, I've had my parents sort of coming and going, visiting. And so I'm thinking a lot about intergenerational issues and relationships and thinking about my relationship to my father as his daughter. And so I think that the sort of new subject matter or a sort of stronger theme coming in will be the writing about family, which has been something I've been engaged with in past books here and there, but I think more consciously it's definitely going to sort of arise to the surface more.
Yes. Well, something that I do, because I have two little ones myself, two under the age of two, three actually, but what I do is I get myself a recorder, and since I don't have a lot of time to write things down, I'll just speak an image into the recorder, and I find that that helps me.
We're talking to Xin Yi Pai, author of Ozark, a book of poems that just came out. One of the interesting things is that even though there is an observer in these poems, I don't feel like I'm reading about you when I'm reading these poems. There's a little bit more distance from you and more closer to the subject, which is of, you know, these observations of the landscape and observations of people within the landscape and how people interact with the landscape.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that that's a very insightful sort of reading or interpretation of the voice or the speaker in my work. So, you know, there are some readers who will perceive that I'm making a direct cultural critique based on my experiences and observations as a person living in, you know, the Deep South, right? But actually, for me, it was very important that I have sort of this critical distance as an observer in my poems so that, you know, I'm not just writing another piece or text that contributes to furthering a stereotype or a misunderstanding about the South necessarily. Mm. I think for me, I'm interested in the sort of complexity of interactions and relationships between people from different geographies or culture. And so that critical distance is very important to me because I want to not just look at, you know, maybe something I'm interested in unpacking or exploring, but also my own positionality and relationship to that subject matter so that I can implicate myself and therefore I think create a sort of more open text.
Let me ask about Peabody Ducks.
Sure.
This poem fascinates me because, like, unlike the other poems, the line breaks are, it fills the entire page. And I'm wondering, in your process, as you're writing, do you write longhand and know what the line breaks are going to be? Or does it just kind of, does it come naturally? Does it come later? At what point did you know this poem needed to be broken up in the way it is?
Yeah, I think I had an idea in my mind as I was writing it about how it might lay out on a page. So a lot of my past work could be described as more visual or concrete in nature. To give a quick example, so a lot of my work is engaged with visual arts, and so I might sometimes take the shape of a poem from, like, a sculpture or a painting that I'm looking at, and that becomes a sort of organic form or shape of the text. And with Peabody Ducks, you know, I was looking at this sort of landscape of ducks in a fountain and thinking about how they configure and reconfigure themselves in sort of what may be random or organized patterns, and thinking about how that could sort of translate onto a page. And so I think probably when I was first drafting the poem, it might not have been all over the page. It might just have been the sort of thread of what I wanted to follow. But then when it came to perhaps drafting it in a more finalized form on the computer, where there's greater, you know, flexibility with moving text around very quickly or easily than, like, with pen to a page, that's where more of the playfulness on the white page actually came out. because I could sort of visualize it more easily on the digital page.
Do you write longhand or do you write on a computer?
I kind of go back and forth. I think that, you know, early drafts of poems and journals are usually handwritten, and I feel that connection to the handwriting of them is very important to me. And then at a point where things feel either more finished or so messy that I can't see the ideas clearly, that's when they kind of move to the computer, and that's the kind of editorial phase, I think, when maybe it's kind of like the revision phase. And you know, sometimes things come a little more fully formed in the handwritten sort of page, but I think it's a kind of flexible practice that goes back and forth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I think that you have to let the poem decide whether it wants to be longhand or written on a computer. We had Mark Strand on the show, and he was telling us that the reason why he writes longhand is because if he writes on a computer or a typewriter, the poem, the first draft looks like it's a finished product.
Sure.
What about the process of putting the book together? Do you print them all out and spread all the pages on the floor and decide the order of it, or do you know the order of it as you're writing? When does that come about?
I would say that as I'm assembling a collection, I'm thinking and reflecting a lot about the different themes that are emerging from the cohesive collection, and maybe keeping a running list of what those are and what seems to be sort of at the forefront, what seems to be in the background, and thinking about the linkages and transitions between these themes of how they might talk to one another. So I kind of then take this list and the printout of all the different texts and poems and do lay them out with an eye towards thinking about how these themes are operating and what sort of works in what place. And I think with this particular collection, that was very important because it then included the sort of curation of images into the mix too, mm-hmm. and thinking about how they might operate as section breaks or not as section breaks, but as kind of almost pauses or commas in some way for a reader to kind of reflect more upon a theme that maybe they were transiting out of. And so I would say that I do always look at the cohesive whole of all of the work when it's near completion, but that there's always this idea in my mind of the trajectory of the work, and so I'm thinking very often in terms of how a whole collection works, even if I don't know at the beginning of writing it what that is going to look like. But at a certain point, those things sort of crystallize before me, and then, you know, things kind of drop into place.
When you write the first poem, for example, do you know that this first poem is going to be connected to other poems, or are you just writing poems?
I think it kind of differs, you know. I think when I was writing my first collection, in the early 2000s, that book Equivalence, I think that was more of an assemblage of different kinds of writing and thinking that I was doing. So in that way, I didn't start assembling that collection with the idea of the theme in mind, but I would say, I would say that holds true too for Ozarks. I was, you know, working on a new collection of poems after finishing Adamantine, and it had come out in 2010, and I was kind of beginning to assemble new work, working on some of the themes that have been important to me throughout my work, so, you know, writing about the visual arts or writing about sort of, you know, Buddhist philosophy. And then it was much later when my husband and I were moving out of Arkansas that it became crystal clear to me that was going to be about place. And so that's kind of how that took shape. But there are some books that I've worked on in the past where it's been very clear to me what I wanted to accomplish with them thematically, and started from that point versus having all this material that I then needed to sort of, reflect on and find the linkages with.
Something that I also noticed is that I see this connection between your photography and your poetry, where in your photography, you have different pictures of just pieces of images, like, for example, like the bathroom sinks or purses or the legs of Barbies, or just these, which is a lot like some of your poems, where they're just kind of like these images in your poetry. You just kind of list different things that kind of like relate to one another, but not really.
Yeah, I like the way that images will sort of pile on top of each other in poems, which are contrasted then with the photographs, which sort of focus in on single images, and to sort of talk about some of the images that you mentioned there. So the kitchen sinks, those were, you know, very deliberately placed in sort of close sequence with the poem Discards, because it was this sort of idea of like the thrown away object, right? And the needle shower was also an image that I photographed in the historic bathhouses and hot springs. And so I wanted that sort of medieval torture-like device to sort of transition nicely into a poem about the sort of labor practices in these bathhouses in, you know, in the mid-1900s, that kind of thing. So definitely there are ways in which they do sort of build and converse with one another. And so I do feel like there are those linkages within this book, yes.
We have been talking to Xinyi Pai, whose book, Ozark, has absolutely everything, including the kitchen sink. And we do have this segment, Xinyi, called Poem of the Week, where we usually read a poem, but when we have a poet on the show, we'd like to ask her to read. Would you be willing to read one of your poems?
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. Do you have a request as to which one?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I do. I love the poem Inner Space.
Inner Space, yeah. That opens the collection. Inner Space. A guide aims her flashlight at the borehole drilled half a century before the build of I-35. Below ground, it's 20 degrees cooler than the blazing temps out there. The cavern where my Texan mate takes me to find relief from heat. Beneath a canopy of pencil-thin soda straw stalactites. The Permian floodwater maze that claimed the lives of Ice Age species. Mammoth armadillo and saber-toothed cat swamped in quicksand. A pyramid of bat guano piled high on the grotto floor, grows taller with time. Past the tailless cone of bone sink, I spot a crumbling tusk, tongue my upper molar, claimed by dental caries, capped 1 month ago in gold. What relics, what remains hereafter?
That was Xinyi Pai reading Inner Space from her wonderful book, Ozark. Xinyi, thank you for joining us for Words on a Wire.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
For Poetic License this week, I am going to reflect a little bit on a moment in high school. In high school, I was four different people. I'm going to call it two stupid boys. I was so many different people in high school. Disco Danny, sporting my unbuttoned fake silk shirts. Stoner boy Chacon, long hair to my butt, selling the best weed in school. And in my senior year, I was the actor, getting lead roles in school plays. As a drama geek, I hung out with a group of creative outcasts who were intensely intelligent but socially unpopular. We did all kinds of stuff together, went to midnight shows of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, went to ice cream shops where we ate banana splits so big clowns brought them out on stretchers. At parties, we listened to soundtracks from Broadway musicals and sang them aloud. I loved the clean fun, but I missed getting stoned and listening to hard rock. One night, I was driving through my neighborhood and I saw two boys from my school, white guys, stoners like I used to be. As I passed, I smelled pot. I pulled over, got out, and walked towards them. They put out the joint and attempted to hide it. "We ain't doing nothing," said the short kid with long red hair, wearing jeans and a Rush t-shirt. "Smells good," I said. The tall kid, blonde hair, big eyes, looked at me suspiciously. He had a black eye, like someone had smacked him good, probably by a giant, because this kid was as huge as a football player. He looked at me, and suddenly a look of recognition spread over his face. He said, "I know you, dude. You're one of those drama geeks. You don't smoke weed." "Try me," I said. He pulled out the joint, handed it to me with a lighter, and I took a big toke. I ended up hanging out with the stoners all night. Billy, the short one with red hair, was my age. Sammy Danes, the tall blonde boy with the black eye, was a freshman, 15 years old. He lived with his father, who was known in the neighborhood as being a drunk. These two stoners weren't that bright, but they had good weed, and they liked it when I cranked my car stereo and played Jimi Hendrix. They didn't have their own cars or stereos. I started to hang out with them every night. We would get stoned, drive around in my car, and listen to rock. When I smoked weed, I couldn't stop thinking about things and talking about whatever came to my mind. One night, I admitted to them that I liked reading Sigmund Freud. "As messed up as he was," I said, "his analysis of Shakespeare is amazing. You guys should hear what he says about the Merchant of Venice." "The Marching of Venus?" asked Sammy Danes. "What's that?" His black eye was faded, but now he had a fresh, fat lip. He said, "Merchants of Venice, stupid," said Billy. "They sell stuff on the beaches in L.A. "It's a Shakespeare," I said. "I hate that crap," said Sammy Danes. "What are you going to major in?" I asked him. "When I turn 18, I'm quitting school," he said. "I'm going to be a welder like my uncle. He makes good money, and he has a girlfriend." One night, I asked Billy and Sammy if they wanted to see something cool. "Chicks?" Billy asked. "No," I said. "Merchants?" Sammy asked. "Rich houses," I said. I told them about the Venice Extension, Fresno's Beverly Hills, and they had never heard of it. "I'm going to show you how rich people live," I said. I was driving through our neighborhood of cars on blocks, dirty walls, garbage in the gutters, and down the rural highway to the Venice Extension, the mansion spreading out on each side of us like magic kingdoms. Some houses had fountains and sculptures on the lawns, the size of parks. "Dang," said Billy, "I ain't never seen nothing like this." "These people are rich," said Sammy Danes in the back seat. Even though he was bigger than the both of us, he was younger, so he had to sit back there. "Huh, Chacon? These people are rich, aren't they?" "They are," I said. "How do they get so much money?" "You could live here someday," I told Sammy. "I ain't never going to make that kind of money." "Sammy's too stupid to do anything with his life," said Billy. "Hey, screw you, Billy. I'm going to be a welder like my uncle." "You could be whatever you want," I said. "A lawyer, a doctor. Nah, I hate school." On the drive back home, the rich subdivision giving way to strip malls and cheap apartments, I wanted to think of something that would help Sammy believe in himself. I was stoned, so I overthought it. He could be saved. I wanted him to see the awesome future that I saw for myself. "I forgot to show you guys something," I said. "You want to see some rich apartments? I mean luxury places like you wouldn't believe?" "Hell yeah," said Billy. Sammy was looking out the back window, excited as a dog. The window rolled down, his head sticking out, blonde hair blowing all crazy. We were passing some cheap apartments, and he pointed. "These?" he asked. "Are these the rich apartments here?" He was excited, as if he were seeing the most beautiful apartments ever, but they were cheap. "No," I said, "those are crap holes." "Oh," he said, deflated. He brought his head back in the car and sat back in his seat. He looked out the opposite window. "My uncle lives in them," he said. I thought, maybe. He didn't finish his sentence. He lit the joint, took a big toke, and held in the smoke for a very long time. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Words on a Wire. And we'd like to thank our guest, Shin Yi Pai. Thank you again, Nancy, for being on the show with me.
No, it's such an honor to be here.
And we'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez, who makes us sound intelligent, because when we screw up in our day-to-day conversations, she edits it out. I'm wondering if there's a way I can manage to take Norma with me everywhere. And so if I ever say something stupid, she can just rewind it and cut it. Thank you, Norma Martinez, and thank you for listening. Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And don't forget,
the next book you read
may save your life. I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight